Hey guys, welcome to episode 113 of the Untangled Faith podcast. Chuck DeGroat returns to the show today for the second time, and we talk about how self-awareness is a good starting point, but incomplete without the next steps. We also talk about the tension of deciding when to weigh in on something and when to remain silent. I've set aside some of this conversation for my supporters on Patreon, so be sure to check that out if you're a patron. If you want in on the fun of supporting the show and having access to all the bonuses my supporters get, check out patreon.com/untangledfaith for more information. As always, there will be a link for you in the show notes. I'm Amy Fritz, and you're listening to the Untangled Faith podcast, a podcast for anyone who has found themselves confused or disillusioned in their faith journey. If you want to hold on to your faith while untangling it from all that is not good or true, this is the place for you. I was thrilled to have this second conversation with Chuck DeGroat. I first met Chuck when I was on the launch team for his book, When Narcissism Comes to Church, in early 2020, before the world shut down. Over the last couple of months, I've been saving up some questions for Chuck, and I'm happy to invite you to pull up a chair and join us for this conversation. Here we are. Welcome to the Untangled Faith podcast, Chuck DeGroat. This is the second time that you've been on the podcast.
Second time. That's exciting.
One of the fun things about having a microphone and a podcast is I get to listen to people. I get to invite them in. So I've been paying attention to a few things you've been sharing online, and I wondered if you would share a little bit deeper of some of these things. And so I'm just going to dive right in. Recently, the president of Calvin University had to resign, and that hit close to home for you. So you have students there that are there, and I would love for you to talk about what that was like for you to process as a dad and somebody that cares about leaders being healthy and organizations making good choices.
Yeah, thanks for asking that, because it did feel more personal. My oldest daughter graduated from there. My youngest is a psychology major, junior there. And I was just sitting with someone this morning, in fact, and here in where I am in West Michigan, there are several really hard things happening right now. It's almost like, I'd said for a while we were dealing, I felt like I was largely engaged in things that were happening in other places. And now in the last year, a number of things have happened here. And so they're hitting closer to home, and their impacts even with a couple of the other situations right here, kind of in our immediate community and seminary community. And I think that there's something about that that is more personal. It's harder, you know, they're... I don't know about you. I'd be curious how you experience these things, but there are times when I'll hear yet another story and it won't evoke sadness or, anger or confusion. I'll just feel sort of a numbness or an apathy. And I don't like that, you know? And I think this particular one was just like, and in part because, you know, the college is losing a president that seemed to have been doing a good job and people were happy with him. But there are people, and I don't know the details of the story, but there are victims whose lives are changed because of the impact of his harm, right? Like they're, and their stories aren't public at this point. I don't know if they'll ever be public, but... and there are students that are really angry. My daughter sent me some pictures of some things that have been written on buildings, justice for the victims. And, you know, and so stories, we're hearing so many stories of harm, but I think in particular when they hit closer to home and in particular when it's my daughter's college, there's just a sadness like, oh, it just keeps happening. Even with people who... You know, you sort of thought they had integrity. That's been what's been happening lately around here is, oh, I thought that was a person of integrity. I thought that was a person who was in therapy and doing his work. I thought, you know, so yeah, it's heartbreaking.
How did you feel about the response of the leadership of the college?
Yeah, so I don't know all the ins and outs. And so in general, people will ask me sometimes, how come you don't comment on more publicly on all the different things that happen? And I often say, I just don't know all the details. I don't know all the I am in enough situations every day with my own clients and my own counseling practice and some of my own consulting work that I just don't have the emotional bandwidth to understand or know what's going on everywhere. But with this, there was sort of an immediacy to the response, like the, at least from what I understand it. It went through a Title IX process, which is an institutional process for adjudicating these things. And the public response was clear that he had done something inappropriate. They didn't give the details, but that he was removed from his role. And there is, I won't go into the details, but there's another institution within West Michigan where that didn't happen. And a number of people have been sort of comparing the two institutions and their responses and how one sort of publicly came out and made the very hard decision to let go of a popular president, right? And the other one tried to save face and create a narrative and do image management in a way that ended up, I think, causing bigger problems and more eruptions within the community.
Yeah.
It's interesting to process after you've seen different places handle things differently. So I was listening to a podcast recently, The Resilient Pastor, and Sharon Hody Miller was on there, and she was talking about you because she ended up interviewing you for that podcast. So you know where I'm going with this.
Yeah.
And what I thought was so fascinating is that she was talking about the resistance she had to reading your book, When Narcissism Comes to Church. She had assumed that it was just full of stories of bad actors and, you know, like she said, a narcissism hunt.
Yeah.
And so I would love to hear you kind of talk about what that was like for you to hear her say that. And then also to hear her say, and then when I read it and I loved it, and now she recommends it to everyone. So like, what was it like for you to process that?
Yeah, it wasn't surprising. And I wasn't sad, disappointed, hurt by it, angered by it, anything like that. I think I understand it, to be honest. I mean, I think there are, I talk to pastors who all the time ask, why have you or Diane Langberg or Wade Mullen or McKnight and Laura Barringer, a number of folks, Amy doing what she's doing, and all of us, why are you making such a big deal about this, right? Or why are you anti-church, or why are you anti-pastor? And I'm able to say, you know, I've been a pastor in Orlando and San Francisco. I currently am an ordained minister. I was involved with church planting for a long, long time. I've served the church in a variety of different ways. I train pastors. I am not anti-pastor. In fact, a large part of what I'm invested in is creating healthy pastors in our work here. But I think a number of us over the years, and I've been at this just in terms of the facets of emotional and spiritual abuse in the church since really the late 90s. I think it's sort of providential that a number of us at a given time began to sense we need to say more, we need to say it more loudly, and begin to name these things. And I do think that there are people that I talk to who feel like, are you attacking us? And I want to try to understand that. I think it's a very lonely place to be. You know, pastoral work today is hard. It's lonely. Pastors are feeling attacked. There might be a sense of picking up my book or someone else's book of well, here's just yet another person who's mad at the church. Yeah. And no, I don't think a number of us would be doing this if we didn't really care, actually, you know, about pastors and about the church.
So what would you say is the difference between narcissism hunting and what you hope to accomplish with your book?
Well, I mean, here's the thing that I have been grateful to hear about some of my writing on this, and that's that people by and large maybe thought that they were going to discover it to be a book on narcissism hunting, and they discovered more graciousness in it. I think part of the reason for that is I am a therapist, and as I've done this work, I don't I don't believe that narcissists wake up in the morning to do their narcissistic thing. You know, I don't think that's how it works. Right. I have bring a much more trauma-informed perspective to this work. Hurt people. Or as Richard Rohr says, you'll transmit what you haven't transformed. And so I have had the privilege of doing this work, and there are not every person on the narcissistic spectrum will let you into the depths of their own story because they are so well protected and defended. But when you get back into the details of their own stories, they have been traumatized. They have been abused. They've been hurt. They've been harmed. They've been shamed. And the real them, the authentic them, is hidden behind these high defensive walls. And I get, maybe you've had this experience too, you get to sort of peer behind it. Oh, there you are. Right. The beautiful image bearer that is you. And there's so much more to you than your bomb throwing. And you get to walk down a path of transformation. And that's the real gift of doing the work ultimately for me.
So you were talking a little bit about self-regulation, and you posted on your Facebook recently about trends of people talking about being self-aware. And you said that this is just the first part of this process.
Yeah.
So what happens if we have self-awareness, but no self-regulation?
Yeah. So this has become big because, as you know, I'm really attuned to this whole phenomenon of vulnerability, FAUX, yeah. Right? This, and really kind of sadly, actually, over the last, 5 years or so, have seen, maybe longer than that, have seen men in particular who will say, I know my Enneagram, I've gone to counseling. I had a guy fly up here and want to sit with me to talk to me about do I have narcissistic tendencies, and tell me about his therapy, and then took a selfie at the end, right? And then put that up. And in the end, I felt so manipulated by it when I found out about that. And I realized, you know, I've been talking about self-awareness for years as the kind of the key to the work, right? And now I think we need to really begin to emphasize just as strongly self-regulation, which is to say, you can know some things about yourself and your story. But if you're not aware of your dysregulated nervous system and how that shows up in fight, flight, fawn, find, which are my four Fs for the sympathetic nervous system, or freeze and fold, the two Fs for your parasympathetic or dorsal system. If you're not aware of these six Fs and how these show up in you, so that fight, that, you know, that oppositional spirit or that need to pull away or however this shows up for you, then you're not going to grow in the ways that you hope to grow. Merely knowing something of your story or what happened in your family of origin or what your Enneagram number is isn't enough, because self-regulation takes you into the immediacy of the moment. And if I'm supercharged, my sympathetic nervous system is, you know, the volume is turned up to 10, and I jump all over you in a fight, you know, but I come back and I say, well, I know I can be like, I'm an 8. I'm like that. Yeah. That's not helpful, you know?
I'm least, aware of it.
Right? So I need to be able to say, oh, I was activated. What was it about what was going on inside of me that where I got activated, and how can I take responsibility? And maybe those are the key words for what's going on inside me. Because 9 out of 10 times, these self-aware people will say, well, Amy, you said that thing that made me get angry, you know? Yeah. So, yeah.
Yeah, I am a very strong 2. So I could see me being like, I just care too much, right? I wasn't trying to manipulate you. I wasn't trying to be strategic and earning your love. That's just who I am.
Yeah.
Okay, so I want to read something to you that you wrote.
Okay.
So in late January, you wrote this. There was another one of those predictable dust-ups this week. I heard where someone from a particular tribe of Christianity was grumpy that women had become too empowered and that Christianity had become too empathic. You know, the kind of peace that only further entrenches one group and alienates another. Someone wrote to me and said, this is the kind of essay you should respond to. And you wrote. I replied, I've gone down that road before and I don't like what it does to me. Yeah, so you wrote a few more things. Tell me about that. I would love to hear you flesh that out a little bit.
So there was this extraordinary woman that lived about 500 years ago named St. Teresa of Avila. I call her the greatest 16th century reformer. You know, apologies to Calvin and Luther and all those folks. But I think she's incredible, an experiential theologian, a woman with lots of fire, a woman who refused to succumb to the sanctioned abuse of her day, a woman who loved Jesus deeply. And I'm not going to be able to get this quote perfectly. She says something to the effect of, you can't save the whole world. It's best to just focus on the circle that you can impact, you know? And I do think that, particularly as we become more globalized, social media, and there are all these things going on in all different kinds of places. I mean, literally there every day when I look at my feed, cause I follow a lot of people who are advocates and allies of, in situations where there has been abuse or harm, you can literally spend every day, all day, every day, responding to some new thing that's happening somewhere. Right. I have 7 to 10 clients that I see a week. I have churches that I consult with. I've got classes that I teach here, and that's my immediate circle. And I have to ask myself, what do I have the capacity for? How can I help in a way in which I remain regulated? And that's a question that is different for each and every one of us. I mean, I don't know if you know the language of high sensitivity, a highly sensitive person, and HSP. Yeah. I would consider myself an HSP. I'm an Enneagram 4. I've got a story of my own abuse and trauma. And so in my own therapy, I've had to be able to identify my limitations. And part of that is being able to say no. When I give my yes to working with a particular client, that's my wholehearted yes. And there are simply times when I know, and I can feel it, probably you've experienced this too, where you start to feel like, oh, I think I need to say something and I realize I don't really know much about what's going on there. And I don't want to read that guy's whole essay. I don't really, it's going to be awful. I know it, you know?
And will it draw more attention to it?
Yeah, will draw more attention. And in the end, I have to take responsibility for me, because that's the me I bring to my relationship with Sarah and my two daughters and my good friends and my students. And if I lived in a constant, what I call sympathetic storm all the time, engaged in all these different kinds of things, I would be perpetually dysregulated. And I have lived there. And in fact, I've lived there as someone who's a therapist and who is saying all the right things, but my own life was contradicting what I was saying. So I was living dysregulated.
So what would you say are those red flags that maybe I'm stepping into a situation that isn't mine to step into?
Yeah, I think this is where, as we do our work, we get really attuned to our own bodies and our own emotions, right? And I think so many of us largely live up here and in reactive mode and unattuned to what's going on. And so I notice I won't name all the kinds of things that I begin to notice within me, but it could be as simple as a clenched jaw. It could be as simple as like a little bit of that's why I immediately put my hand on my chest here, because I start to feel a little bit of tension, and goes up into my throat, my face. And as soon as I begin to notice a bit of what's happening in my body and a bit of what's happening emotionally, that's a cue to me to step back and ask, okay, so Chuck, what's really going on? Get a little bit of separation and get present. I think that's the first piece. I think the second one, and I think you mentioned some version of this earlier, is I thankfully had some people in my life over the years who said, you know, that thing that you just posted, a few hours ago, I wonder about that. I wonder what was going on with you. And they're not in a judgy kind of way, but I just wonder what was going on. Are you okay? And I'll look back and I'll say, oh, yeah, that was kind of rapid fire. Like, I had seen that and I was so angry, and I just wanted to release some energy, because there's a discharge of energy within. Right. When you right. finally get that tweet out, it is a way of self-soothing, and not all ways of self-soothing are healthy. Right. And so I'll go back and I'll realize, yeah, I really went into a kind of fight mode there that. And so, yeah, again, this, I think it, you've been doing your work for a long time. I've been doing my work for a long time. And it's amazing that there are still places where you just don't see it. And you react. And thankfully, well, if you've got some good friends who know you, know your proclivities, they'll call you up or send you a text a few minutes later and say, how are you doing? What was going on there?
What was that? What was that about?
Yeah, to keep remembering that we're susceptible to all the unhealthy things that we keep saying, hey, look at that. That's bad. Don't do that. You know, I could do that myself.
Yeah.
I don't like that.
No, no. I've done that with clients too, you know, and I've got to recognize even in therapy, you know, there are times when, you know, I'll see some dynamic unfolding in a marital counseling session and I will shame a husband that has, you know, and I'll recognize a moment later, I only pushed him further into defensiveness. But my reaction had something to do with an old story that was restoring in me at that moment, you know, in which I chose to power up instead of approach him from a more grounded place. And so it takes a lot of, I think, you know, a number of us, you included, have been talking a lot about character lately and character formation. And character formation takes years, decades. You know, it's not, I'll often say it's not a one-off class in seminary here. And it takes us growing in a sense of our own integrity so that we're able to catch ourselves. We've got others who will catch us, but I want to close the gap in terms of the time it takes for me to catch myself. And I think that that's a measurement of character and growth, is when you close that gap in timing and you realize, and I can say to my client, I am sorry, I just shamed you. And I wonder how that felt when I jumped on you like that, you know?
Yeah.
You've said one of the most powerful things that you can ask someone is, how do you experience me? And that makes me think about Pete Singer, who's the executive director at Grace. And he says that it's much more vulnerable for an organization to open themselves up to a full assessment of organizational health than it is to open them up to a third-party investigation of some sort of specific abuse. He says it's much more vulnerable. It's like asking that question, how do you experience me?
Yep.
And that is a very scary question to ask.
It's a scary question to ask. You're right. And I think Pete's spot on. I mean, I've told this story before in different places, but there's a little part of me that likes the feeling of being the guy who says, I ask the question, how do you experience me, you know, and feels like, oh, well, whenever I say that out loud, people are going to think, well, Chuck is really a grown up, you know, and then someone comes and tells me, and I sometimes tell the story of the student who meekly came up to my office and sat down and said, do you really want an answer to that question?
Oh, wow.
And the feeling inside of me was, you know, the immediate feeling was, no, I'm your professor. And I didn't say this out loud, by the way, but no, you don't get to tell me. Like, and then I took a deep breath and I said, I'm here. I'm open. Tell me what you experienced. And he went on to say, you know, I've been in a very busy season, and I ignored him a number of times when I was walking through the halls, and he just felt ignored. He felt missed and ignored. And he said, you're the one who talks a lot about presence, and I have experienced you as very, very absent. And and it's just, that's the part, right? So it's easy to say it in a conversation like this one, Amy, but it's a much harder thing when you're sitting there vulnerably and someone's sharing with you. And I know my inner resistance is like, parts of me come out and I want to say, no. I get to ask that theoretically, but you don't get to, you know?
My heart is racing just thinking about that. I don't think I've ever even asked my husband this question of how he's experienced me. Yeah. It terrifies me.
Yeah.
I wanted to bring up something I've been thinking about for a couple months, and I think I mentioned it in my email when I reached out to you. Several months ago in a sermon, our pastor was sharing, and he started out by reminding us of this scene from the Hook movie with Robin Williams. And Robin was finally reunited with Wendy, Grandma Wendy. I think Maggie Smith played that role. And she's seeing him. It's been 10 years. And Wendy wants to know what Peter has been up to. And Robin's young boy, Robin Williams' character, Peter, his young boy, kind of interrupts him. And he's like, my dad goes in when companies are kind of struggling. And he blows them out of the water. And Robin is, you know, Peter, Robin's trying to interject and say, well, actually, I'm in mergers and acquisitions. And, you know, and the son just keeps saying and shoots them out of the water. And then, you know, Wendy looks at Peter and says, Peter, you've become a pirate. And in the sermon, our pastor was talking about that Micah passage, about what the Lord requires of us, you know, these three things, justice, mercy, and humility, and about how when you're missing any one of these things, we could easily become pirates. And so that's a long story, just to ask you the question, how does that land for you? Like, how do we not become pirates? Those things that we point to, those people that we point to and say, danger, I need to ask myself, how can I not be that person? How can I not become that pirate?
Yeah, so I grew up in a tradition that said you are a pirate to your core. You're bad to your core. I serve in a Reformed institution. Yeah. We call ourselves generously Reformed. It's very different. We're fully egalitarian. Yeah. In fact, we have to sign that we are egalitarian as professors. But like, so it's a very different. But that's still in the air, that sense that you're bad to your core. I happen to think that justice, mercy, love, compassion, humility, these things are core. They are our deepest inheritance. They're bestowed to us. They're not something we have to go find. It's almost like we get to, like when I'm doing the work with people, I get to unearth the goodness of who they are, you know, and When you do that work, when you're engaged in that work personally, and when you do that work, you know, for me in the counseling room or through spiritual direction, what's beautiful is you begin to see a heart beat for justice. Like, that's not right. You want to see repair where there's been brokenness. You grow in humility. You don't need the spotlight. You don't demand it. It actually feels good. It feels better to live in this place. You know, mercy just sort of naturally flows from you because there's a genuine empathy. You care, and it's not a manipulative sort of empathy where it's like, what's the temperature in the room and how can I work it, you know?
Yeah.
We don't have to sort of like figure out how to do this. We do need to sort of find our way to the depths of who we are, and that beating heart, you know, that the deepest core self, the image of God's self, that I call the work that I do sometimes excavation work, because we're removing rubble, and there's a lot of rubble from our pasts, right? Like there's a lot of rubble that has kept me inwardly oriented and not as merciful, or more prone to bitterness than prone to justice. And as I do my own work, and as I identify these parts of me that are self-protective, right, and befriend them, and bless them and offer peace to them, there is a sense in which I can, you can, we all can live from that deep heart God created us for, in love, goodness, faith, gentleness, meekness, all the things that are, you know, that are that the Bible describes in various places. And so I often say in the work that I do, the greatest asset is that I'm working with image bearers, and I don't care if they call themselves Christians or not, but I know their deepest DNA. And so now we just get to sort of remove those things that keep them from living from the core of who they are. And that's really, I love that I get to do that work. That's really fun.
Yeah, it seems like we've sort of talked around this whole idea of seeing the whole picture and how things get off balance. So like you said, in the Reformed world, there's this idea of worm theology. And I'd argue That's a very incomplete description of who we are. I was just talking to my friend Heather, and she helps lead worship at our church. And she often tells the person that chooses the songs, I don't want to sing about how I'm a terrible person. I don't want to sing that because that is a very incomplete picture of who I am. I'm created in God's image. I'm not just a terrible, terrible worm. And so, you know, all that just to say, when we miss that part, we get out of whack in a way that is unhealthy for all of us. So I appreciate that.
Yeah.
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 So I have this last question for you as we wrap up. I'm curious what you're paying attention to that is encouraging you these days.
So that's a good question. I think that on any given day, you know, the emails that I'll get or the social media things that you and I'll scroll through, things like that, there are a lot of really painful stories. And we can miss the really redemptive ones. I mean, there are really good pastors and their beautiful churches doing good work. And just recently, for instance, I was able to bear witness. I was able to consult a little bit from a distance, but really a lot of it was bearing witness to a church that and two pastors, a woman and a man who sort of co-pastor, who heard the story of a woman who had been abused by another pastor in a different space and took that story with great seriousness, cared for her really well, and engaged a process that was really well done, protected her, got her care, really centered the process on her in all the right ways. And I watched this whole thing unfold, and I was like, oh, there it is. It happens. We can do this. And I get to see that every now and then, and that really encourages me. I get to talk to, I was in the church planting world for a while, and I get to talk to, and they're mostly church planters and leaders in this area of color who are thinking very, very differently than we were all thinking 20 years ago in our more sort of colonialist paradigm of church planting, or more patriarchal, or more.
Yes.
And who they're not tweaking like they're for a while there. It was just like, let's tweak this or let's just change this test, or but they're fundamentally rethinking how we go about like being the church and planting churches. And I'm really just listening to them because I know very little about those kinds of things, and they're able to bring their own unique experiences. I'm a 53-year-old white male, so my imagination is quite small because I've been swimming in the same waters for a long, long time. But I think that the last thing I'll say, and this is along the same lines, is of just bearing witness to what others are doing. There are just some profound voices that I'm learning from, and oftentimes they're younger, they're 20 years younger than me at times, and women of color who have become my teachers. And like probably in the last 2 years, Cole Arthur Riley has become one of those, her writings, This Here Flesh. And I'm just sort of like, if you have the eyes to see, there's such goodness and capacity for healing and dignity and worth and belonging that in the midst of, and there's a lot of bad. And another one just dropped here yesterday, and it's really painful for where, I mean, it was the president of Calvin a few days ago, and just another one dropped yesterday. There's a lot of pain, but there's also a lot of goodness all over the place if you have the eyes to see.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that reminds me of Fred Rogers, how he said, anytime that there's something really dark and hard happening in the world, to look for the helpers. I think that's true in our world too. Anytime there's a flaming dumpster fire, there's somebody there. There are helpers that are showing up, and that's really beautiful.
Yeah, I love that. Yeah, I love that. That's really well said.
Thanks, Fred.
What about you? What are you seeing? Can I ask you that?
Oh, that's a great question. I did not prepare to answer that myself. I would say I'm looking for the helpers too. I love seeing that there's a creative way to approach things that are hard, and that the solution is not dependent on me. That's a great encouragement to me. Sometimes it's hard for me to step back and say, I'm going to trust that this is going to work out without me. it can be hard to do that, but what a beautiful thing when it works out, because 99% of the time I can step back and realize that it's going to be fine. This does not depend on me. And that, I guess I'd say that encourages me. And I think that's sustainable.
Yeah. That's really good. Oof.
Thank you, Chuck.
I'm just so glad. I mean, we've never met in person, but I feel like we're friends from a distance. Whenever I see you, it's like, oh, I know her on the weird virtual world we live in. So thank you for who you are and what you do, what you offer.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Thanks so much for listening to this episode. If you are interested in hearing more of our conversation, join us over on Patreon at patreon.com/untangledfaith. That's patreon.com/untangledfaith. I want to give a special thank you to those of you who have invested in the show. Your support means the world to me and makes all of this possible. Check out the show notes in your podcast player or at untangledfaithpodcast.com/episodes. There you can find information on how to find my show guests, support their work, and I've curated a list of episodes I think you might enjoy. If you want to keep this conversation going, come find me on Facebook or Instagram or Threads. I'm Untangled Faith on Facebook and Instagram, and you can find me on Threads at Amy Henning Fritz. Come find me and tell me what you think of this conversation or any of the conversations we've had here. Thanks so much for listening. I'll see you next week.